Construction work promotes progress. As the number of kingdom publishers grew, so did the need for kingdom halls, assembly halls, and enlarged branch facilities. How did these become available? Before 1975, the Government Lands Department regularly set aside new blocks of land for religious use. Interested churches applied for the allotments and argued their case before a government-appointed land board. The successful bidder received the land free of charge, but had to build on it within a reasonable period of time. In 1963, despite stiff opposition from Christendom's clergy, the International Bible Students Association secured a lease on a prime Port Moresby property. The hillside allotment had stunning views of Coke Market and the azure coral sea. A two-story branch office and Kingdom Hall was later built on this site. Subsequent land grants in Port Moresby were used to build Kingdom Halls at Sebema, Hohola, Garahoo, and Gordon. The Gordon site, which had a commanding position near the center of town, was originally earmarked as the future location of an Anglican cathedral. At the public hearing, however, the land board chairman told the Anglican minister that the board was not pleased with the way that the church had hoarded land and often misused it for commercial purposes, explains Ron Finn, who served in Papua New Guinea for 25 years. The chairman added that the Anglicans would not receive any more land until the board was satisfied that they were using their current allotments for the purpose for which they were intended. After saying this, the chairman turned to me and asked me about our land requirements. I told him that our first preference was the cathedral block at Gordon. The Anglican minister sprang to his feet to object, but the chairman firmly told him to sit down. I completed my presentation. To the amazement of everyone present, the committee awarded our congregation the land. A Kingdom Hall and the four-story branch office were built on this site. The new branch facility was dedicated on December 12, 1987. The earlier Koki site was sold. Between 2005 and 2010, a four-story residence, a Kingdom Hall, and a translation office were added to the branch facilities. These buildings were dedicated on May 29, 2010. Today, there are 89 Kingdom Halls and other meeting places across the country. In many rural areas, local bush materials are still used in the construction of meeting places. However, in larger towns, modern building materials are used. Many of these newer halls have been built under the Program for Lands with Limited Resources, which has operated in Papua New Guinea since 1999. Persevering despite challenges. The various religions operating in Papua New Guinea had a gentleman's agreement as to where each mission could operate. Each church group had their own territory and expected other religions to keep well away. Of course, Jehovah's Witnesses share the good news with all who want to hear it, no matter where they live. This stand, and the positive response of many who listened to the truth, angered the clergy. After I moved to the small island of Kermalik, West New Britain, one of my first callers was an Anglican priest, recalls Norm Shireen. "You have no right to witness in my parish," he said. "The people are already Christians." Later, I saw one of my Bible students frantically paddling his dugout toward the shore in heavy rain and seas. In fact, he was risking his life by being out in such weather. He pulled his dugout up onto the beach and, panting heavily, told me that a boat full of Catholics, led by a catechist, was coming to beat me up. I had nowhere to run, and I turned to Jehovah for wisdom and strength. When the boat arrived, about 15 men disembarked, their faces painted red, a sure sign of ill will. Instead of waiting for them to come to me, I walked down to meet them. Earlier, I felt afraid, but now the fear was gone. As I approached, they spoke abusively to me, hoping that I would give them an excuse to get physical, but I remained calm. Also on the scene was another of my Bible students, an elderly man who actually owned the island. With the best of intentions, he said to the men, "Jehovah's Witnesses don't fight. Go ahead, hit him. You'll see. Whose side is he on? I said to myself, wishing he would be quiet. After reasoning with the men for several minutes, I suggested that they leave, and as a gesture of goodwill, I offered my right hand to their leader. Surprised, he looked around at the others, and they at him. Then he shook my outstretched hand. This broke the tension, and we all shook hands. After that, they left, much to my relief. I could not help but think of Paul's words to Timothy. A slave of the Lord does not need to fight, but needs to be gentle toward all, keeping himself restrained under evil. 2 Timothy 2:24. Bernt Andersen recalls that in one Highlands village, the Lutheran pastor and a mob of about 70 men from another village tried to chase the witnesses away and destroy their kingdom hall. Bernt put the mob off balance by going outside the village to meet them. He approached the pastor and asked why the Lutheran mission says God's name is Anutu, a local name adopted by some of Christendom's missionaries. The pastor said that it was in the Bible. So Bernt asked where. The pastor opened his Bible, and when it was obvious that he could not find such a scripture, Bernt invited him to read Psalm 83:18. After receiving help to find the book of Psalms, the pastor began to read aloud. When he came to the name Jehovah, he shut the Bible and shouted, "That's a lie!" Too late, he realized that he had just condemned his own Bible. After that episode, many of his followers changed their attitude toward the witnesses. At times, religious opposers did burn down bush kingdom halls, as in the village of Uggy, in Milne Bay Province. In this instance, though, one of the arsonists, who was drunk at the time of the offense, deeply regretted his actions. In fact, he later approached the brothers, accepted a Bible study, and became a pioneer. Moreover, he was offered the use of the pioneer house adjacent to the rebuilt hall. Thus, he now found himself caretaker at the very location where he had committed the crime. Today, religious persecution has all but stopped. "We have entered a period of peace," says Craig Spiegel. But another problem has developed, violence, often caused by hoodlums and thieves called rascals. Hence, when witnessing in dangerous areas, the brothers work in groups and keep one another in sight. "It helps to be known as witnesses," say missionaries Adrian and Andrea Riley. "Whether you are shopping or preaching, it's prudent to carry literature," says Adrian. "Granted, this may not guarantee your safety, but it may be of help because it identifies you as a minister of Jehovah. On one occasion, my car broke down in a rough part of Lai. I was alone, and before long a gang of menacing-looking youths gathered around. Thanks to a Bible discussion we had recently had together, two of them recognized me. As a result, they spoke up for me. So instead of stealing anything or harming me, the whole group, much to my surprise and relief, pushed my disabled car the full quarter of a mile back to the missionary home." In another instance, a sister was in a market when rascals armed with knives whispered to her, "Give us your bag." She immediately handed it over, and they ran off. A few minutes later, they returned, apologized, and gave her back the bag with all its contents. Why? When they opened the bag, they saw her Bible and reasoning book and felt guilty about what they had done. Diverse preaching methods. "We preached wherever we found people," reminisced Elsie Thu, who served in Papua New Guinea with her husband Bill from 1958 to 1966. "We spoke to people in their villages, in their homes, in their gardens, in the markets, and along bush tracks. We spoke to fishermen on beaches and riverbanks. In the early days, we also carried a map of the world so that we could show people in the more isolated areas where we came from. This was important because sometimes we arrived by air, and the villagers, unaware of the outside world, thought we dropped in from heaven. So we showed them that we simply came from another part of the same world as theirs." The only way to reach many of the villages that pepper Papua New Guinea's long coastline and numerous riverbanks is by boat or canoe. Steve Blendy recalls, Brother Dairaguba from Hanuabada, Port Moresby, was an aged man and had a lot of experience with watercraft. He had 2 hollowed-out logs under his house, so my pioneer partner and I helped him to obtain the timber he needed to build a puapua, a local form of catamaran. The sail was made of canvas. With Daira as captain and 2 or 3 other brothers from Hanuabada as crew, we made quite a few trips to coastal villages near Port Moresby. In the late 1960s, Bernt Andersen was serving on New Ireland, a beautiful island some 400 miles northeast of the mainland. Bernt writes, People came from the small islands nearby, asking us to visit them. In order to do so, however, we needed a boat, which seemed an impossible dream in view of our small monthly reimbursement. We did have a few planks stored in a shed, but not nearly enough to build a boat. So we took the matter to Jehovah in prayer. Then, out of the blue, a brother in Lai sent us $200 to help us visit the outer islands. Thus, we were able to build a boat, which we named Pioneer. However, it lacked an engine. Once again, that dear brother provided the funds we needed, this time to purchase a small outboard motor. Now we could answer the call to visit those picturesque islands. About 1990, a circuit overseer, Jim Davies, along with 3 other brothers, made plans to witness to a refugee camp far up the Fly River near the border of Indonesia. The brothers had arranged for accommodations with an interested woman whose husband was second in charge of the camp. The trip up the Fly River took nearly 2 hours in a motorized dugout canoe, says Jim. At about 9 o'clock in the morning, we arrived at a clearing in the jungle, where we saw a dirt road that led to the distant camp. We waited there for transportation. Finally, at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, a vehicle showed up. We loaded our supplies, climbed in, and went only about 100 yards before the steering mechanism broke. Unperturbed, the driver identified the problem, found some fencing wire, slid under the car, and tied the separated parts together. That won't get us far, I thought. But I was wrong. The wire held for the duration, 5 hours, all of it in 4-wheel drive because of the state of the road. Many times, in fact, we got stuck in mud and had to push the vehicle out. We arrived at 10 o'clock that night, weary and covered with mud. For 3 days we witnessed in the camp, which was scattered over a wide area of jungle, and placed all of our literature. We also met a disfellowshipped man who expressed the desire to return to Jehovah. Later, we were thrilled to learn that he did come back. Also, his wife and some of his children are now in the truth. The same is true of the interested woman and her husband who kindly gave us accommodations. The following is from pages 125 and 126 of the printed edition. What have you to say for yourself? Mekui Mareg, born 1954, baptized 1986. Profile. She pioneered alone for many years on an island having no other witnesses.
In 1980, I accepted a tract from a pioneer in Madang and took it back home to Bugabug Island, 6 hours away by boat. I liked what it said and wrote to the branch office requesting more information. Soon afterward, I received a letter from Badam Duvun, a pioneer in Madang, inviting me to attend a district convention. I visited her for 2 weeks and started to study the Bible. I also attended all the meetings at the local Kingdom Hall. When I returned home, I continued to study, but by correspondence. Before long, I started Bible studies with 12 other families on Bugabug Island. We held regular meetings in my uncle's home, following the pattern for group Bible study that I had seen in Madang. This angered my father, a prominent member of the Lutheran Church. I know Yahweh, but do not know Jehovah, he thundered. I opened my Tok Pisin Bible and showed him the footnote on Exodus 3:15, which discusses the divine name. My father had nothing to say in response. Three times he summoned me to appear before church leaders to defend my faith. One of these meetings was held in the largest church on the island. Over 100 people filled the building. The atmosphere was tense. "What have you to say for yourself?" demanded the chairman. "I only want to follow Matthew 6:33 and put God's kingdom first," I replied, holding my Bible tightly. My father leaped to his feet. "Are you trying to teach us?" he bellowed in rage. One of my uncles rose to strike me, but another relative jumped to my defense. The meeting descended into chaos. Finally, I was dismissed. My troubles, however, were far from over. Tragically, one of the women attending the meetings we were holding had a sick baby who died. Some in the community blamed me for the death, saying that it happened because I was teaching the mother a new religion. My father, wielding an iron bar, drove me from our family home. I fled to Madang with my aunt, Lamit Mereg, who had also accepted the truth. Soon afterward, we were both baptized. In time, my father became very sick. I took him into my home at Madang and cared for him until he died. During that time, his heart softened toward my religion. Before he died, he urged me to return to Bugabug Island and preach to its inhabitants. This I did in 1987. My relatives kindly built me a small house, and for 14 years, I was the only witness there. For 12 of those years, I served as a regular pioneer. Later, I returned to Madang to pioneer along with Lamit. In 2009, six individuals from Bugabug Island came to Madang to attend the annual memorial of Christ's death. I never married, and I rejoice that I have been able to use my singleness to serve Jehovah fully. Returning to the account.